We are going to drain the swamp.
And now part three of The Swamp. This is our series leading up to the midterm elections in the United States in 30 days. This morning, we wade into the role of emotion in politics.
Molly Tibbetts, an incredible young woman, is now permanently separated from her family. A person came in from Mexico illegally and killed her.
They are the fake, disgusting news.
President Trump is warning of violence if Republicans lose the midterm elections and Democrats take over up on Capitol Hill.
You'd be turning over your rifles.
Get them out of here. Get out. Get them out of here.
Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail was written by the legendary gonzo journalist Hunter S. Thompson about the 1972 presidential campaign won in a landslide by Richard Nixon. 44 years later, Fear and Loathing were front and center in the 2016 presidential campaign, along with disgust, contempt, and anger. The anger remains palpable among the faithful attending the rallies for Donald J. Trump and among the anti-Trump protesters outside those rallies. The air bristles with anger in the conservative American heartland and on the liberal East and West coasts. People are angry about globalization, economic inequality, and immigration. They are angry at elites and a political correctness run amok. People are angry at Trump and at people who voted for Trump. Trump fans and Trump detractors are so angry they can't even talk to each other. Raw emotion has become a decisive feature of politics in the United States and in many other parts of the democratic world. In part three of The Swamp this morning, we're going to examine the pitfalls of the politics of passion with Joseph Heath. He teaches political philosophy at the Monk School of Global Affairs and Public Policy at the University of Toronto. He is also the author of Enlightenment 2.0, Restoring Sanity to Our Politics, Our Economy, and Our Lives. Joseph Heath is with me in our studio in Toronto. Welcome back, sir.
Oh, hi, Michael.
Good to see you.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Personal question.
Yes.
We keep hearing about how angry voters are and how that's affecting the way they vote. Have you ever made a good decision when you were angry?
Not that I can recall, actually. I mean, I'm not like a super angry guy.
Right.
But, I mean, if you just ask me, like, when's the last time you made a good decision, I guess I'm probably coming up with it. But typically, states of emotional arousal are not the best time to be making decisions.
Particularly serious ones.
That's right. That's right. You know, I wrote that book saying, oh, we need to be more rational. And I wasn't trying to be a sort of reason fascist, Mr. Spock type. So people would say, well, when should we be rational? And so the little rule of thumb I had was that if you're facing a decision or if you're in an environment that's close to that of the environment of evolutionary adaptation, then probably your emotions and intuitions are a good guide to decision making.
Run that by me again. Right?
So, like, if you're in an environment that resembles the African savanna, a face-to-face interaction with a person over, like, how to start a fire or, like, what to eat for dinner, that kind of thing. In other words, like, what our ancestors were facing at the time that our brain did most of its evolving.
Right.
Then your gut reaction and your first emotion reaction is probably a reasonable guide to what to do. But if you're in, you know, one of these completely artificial environments, like a modern society. So if you're sitting there staring at a computer screen, you're up at 2 o'clock in the morning under artificial illumination, and you're contemplating, you know, some institutional bureaucratic problem, whatever. Like, that environment is so foreign to that, the environment in which your brain did most of its evolving. That's when you should probably be trying to, like, cool down and think rationally about the problem.
So the gut reaction wouldn't be appropriate
That's right.
At that time.
Yeah, right. You know, if you're looking right at someone's face and saying, are they mad at me? Your brain's actually got a huge amount of specialized routines and hardware designed to read people's facial expressions, body language to figure that out. But if you're reading an email from somebody and you're trying to say, is this person angry at me? Your innate reaction is you've got no equipment to deal with that, right? And so then you have to do a lot of correction where you have to say, well, you know, they said so-and-so, but you have to then think to yourself, well, but that could be a joke. Like, it's really hard. You know how it is with email and et cetera, right? So that's a kind of my rough guideline as to when you should go with the flow emotionally and when you should try to pay more attention.
All right. Now, let's apply those elements to what's going on in the United States. How have these emotions, anger, fear, hatred, and so on, how have they come to play such a highly charged role in American politics?
Well, I think there are good reasons and then there are bad reasons for it. To be charitable, let's start with good reasons. That is that the American political system is dysfunctional in lots of ways that the Canadian political system is not dysfunctional.
Right.
The Canadian system is also reformable, which means that if there's an ongoing problem, it's actually possible to change the structure of our... So, you know, you and I both remember the repatriation of the Constitution, the introduction of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. Yep. I mean, there have been big changes in our lifetimes in our political system. Whereas if you look at the American political system, it's very much locked in by the Constitution and by the set of practices. And so the system itself can't be reformed. And to the extent that it's not producing outcomes that people want, they get increasingly frustrated, in part because not only is the system not performing, but it just seems like it's never going to get better. We had this big debate in Canada about reforming the voting system. In the United States could benefit enormously from reforming their voting system, proportional representation, stuff like that. So I talked to American colleagues and friends. I say, so why isn't anybody pushing it? And they're just like, what's the point? Right? Yeah. Like, I mean, think of how many problems in the U.S. Congress could be fixed by going to proportional representation. Far more problems than we have in Canada.
Never happen.
Exactly. Yeah. It'll never happen, right? So everyone agrees it'll never happen. So it's not even worth talking about. So people have gotten increasingly frustrated over time. And so I just gave you like a classic academics analysis of it in terms of the structure of the institutions, which is, of course, not how people think about it. People think about it in terms of people. And so when you've got a really frustrating political system and it's not working for them, they think, well, I got to send somebody in there who's going to shake things up a bit.
Have you ever seen it in your lifetime where the political climate is as toxic, there's the word that everyone uses, and as angry as it is now, or is it simply being amplified by media?
Well, so I don't have a living memory of the 1960s, and I have a childhood memory of the 1970s. But, I mean, my impression is that the political climate in the United States was actually angrier at that time. There was certainly more political violence at the time.
Very much. There were riots, cities were on fire, there were assassinations.
Yeah, so the big difference is that the public discourse was not as angry. And that has a lot to do with the way in which people are now doing an end run around the media. There's a lot greater public expression of anger and resentment now. So you see it. It's visible. You just have to go on Twitter or whatever, and you can see toxicity right there. And I think a lot of that stuff, there was more of a lid kept on it. For example, think of that which made it into print in 1967. Almost 100% of it would have been edited by somebody.
Certainly.
Right? Like everything went through an editor. Yeah. And editors tone things down, right? I mean, the mere fact that you've got another set of eyes looking at something. But editors often say, you know, write it kind of exuberantly and then we'll tone it down.
Right.
Because it's easier to tone things down than to pump them up, right? So people kind of write, you know, strong stuff. And then another set of eyes would look at it. And so whenever you're reading, back in the 60s and 70s, say, you're reading something in a newspaper, reading a book or whatever, it's had multiple sets of eyes looking at it and deliberating about whether you want to put that out there. Now you look at the amount of written content that's out there and you ask how much of it's been edited. And it's maybe like 1 or 2%, right? So people are just going directly with blogging, Facebook, and so on and so forth. So now you're getting just direct articulation of people's feelings and often composed really quickly and sent off as well.
The philosopher, University of Chicago, Martha Nussbaum, she's got a new book out. And in it, she writes that anger is the result of fear, or one of the results, and that many Americans are fearful about their economic circumstances. Things are getting worse. It's going to be worse for their children and so on. And that causes them to lash out or to vote in anger. Is that a workable thesis?
I mean, Martha Nussbaum is one of these sort of ultra-cerebral people who then spent her, a significant part of her career talking about the emotions.
Yes.
But I mean, she's like a bit of an Apollonian or a bit of a Martian when it comes to understanding human emotions. So she tends to provide really sort of rationalizing accounts of people's emotions. And so I'm not as persuaded that there are these underlying causes that can be addressed by policy and so on and so forth. I mean, I think that there's a variety of things that are motivating people's emotions, but a lot of them are actually really superficial. So
fear isn't superficial, is it? If I'm afraid of losing my job, or I've lost it, I'll never get another one because I'm so old or something, that's hardly superficial.
Well, fear is also highly contagious, for example. You know, there are many examples of someone panics in the subway and then
a stampede develops and so forth.
Right? Well, old-fashioned broadcast media very much made it difficult for those kinds of dynamics to occur in our kind of shared symbolic space. Where some of the social media platforms, Facebook in particular, they allow that kind of propagation of emotion, sentiment, and also rumor and so forth. Right. So Facebook is actually the worst when it comes to this.
Right.
Of allowing these kinds of like waves of panic and of herd mentality to spread. Right. So before Donald Trump took over the term fake news, I mean, that's exactly what fake news was. There was a town in Romania where people were like making up articles for fun.
Yeah.
And then some of them would hit a nerve and then people would send it to their friends and then they would send it to their friends and so forth, right? Now, but if you look at the emotional tone of what propagates on those platforms, fear and anger and outrage, that tends to be the dominant emotional tone of what gets reproduced on those platforms. By the way, on both left and right.
Is Donald J. Trump the cause or the result of those emotions?
Well, I think Trump is a fascinating character. I mean, one of the things about Trump is that he's clearly one of the most visibly emotional U.S. presidents, certainly in my memory. He may have a limited emotional range, but one of the things that's really striking about him is his extraordinary emotional vulnerability in public, primarily his neediness, right? Like, but it's an emotional neediness. Trump actually really speaks to something deep in the American character, right? I mean, Americans didn't elect Vladimir Putin. Partly because Americans don't have the stomach for that kind of strong guy. So they claim they want a strong man. But there's also a kind of sentimentality and mawkishness about the American culture and a kind of emotionalism, right? So, and Trump weirdly satisfies both. So he's got this big obsession with social dominance and being the alpha male. But partly because he's so cognitively impaired when it comes to seeing how other people see him. Like you get the sense that he just doesn't understand how he looks. Yeah, to people, right? Because most of those kind of alpha male types are really unemotional. Whereas Trump is out there and he'll say stuff like, oh, you know, so-and-so, he's always said such nice things about me. I got to tell you, it feels great when you do that or whatever. And it's like, you know, you just said that out loud on television, right? Like people may think that, but nobody
says that out loud,
right? But he'll just sort of say like, you know, I feel so great when people say nice things about me, right? And so that's emotional, right? I mean, think about Obama. Obama was cool and detached, right? So no drama Obama. Emotionally, he clearly did not need his supporters. He needed their votes. But he had no emotional need for his supporters, or he certainly didn't get that sense from the guy. Whereas Trump goes to these rallies, and it's clear that every single person out there screaming is actually feeding this man's needs, right?
It's like political insulin. He needs it.
He's a very emotional man, right? And that's kind of, in many ways, that's what Americans want. They want emotion, but they don't want vulnerability.
But in wanting the emotion, though, they seem to embrace the anger. In the 2016 campaigns, you remember, people were angry at the elites. They were livid about Hillary Clinton, lock her up, lock her up. People are even chanting that at Kathleen Wynne at some Doug Ford rallies. Do you think that people actually know what they're angry about? Or they're just angry at anything or everything?
I tend to think it's pretty diffuse. And so that's why I meant sort of by superficial. It's not as though this one thing happened to me, this important thing happened to me in my life, and that's driving my political anger. It tends to latch onto very symbolic affronts, but it also is like easily displaced. So if a politician were to come, if you say, what are you mad about? And then you say blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And then the politician goes and fixes that thing. And then they say, are you happy now? No, people have just moved on to something else to be angry about, right? It's fitting certain kinds of needs that people have, obviously emotionally, but also socially, right? Like it gets reproduced by the way people around you are talking and what they sound like. So that's why I was saying certain social media platforms obviously reproduce it. Because if all your friends are always angry about everything, it's hard not to get caught up in that as well.
But the anger seems to present itself in the people voting for things that are clearly against their own interests. They vote about their health insurance and environmental protection and so on. Doesn't that mean that this is embedded in that feeling? It's dangerous for the polity, isn't it?
Yeah, if you ask Americans, you know, polls of Americans, there have been lots done in the last couple of years about what are they so angry about. So the number one thing they say they're angry about with their government is that government only serves the interests of the rich and wealthy.
Right.
You know, so then you elect Donald Trump, who enacts like a huge tax cut. And so my thought is, well, that's objectively not going to reduce the extent to which Americans are angry at government for serving the rich and the wealthy, right? The thought that you're going to elect the rich and the wealthy to solve that particular problem seems particularly implausible. But so then you have to wonder whether that's what's really going on. I mean, this is something Thomas Frank wrote that book, What's the Matter with Kansas?
They call it
the What's the Matter with Kansas problem, which is why do Americans insist on voting against their own economic interests. There is a whole status interest as well that obviously drives a lot of Trump's vote, so that it's not so much about government at all, but rather it's about their perceived. So like, you know, your typical like male, like no college education, you know, maybe voting because of a perceived status injury from all these other groups or in line ahead of them and so forth. So then they're not voting against their interests. They're just voting against their economic interests.
Has anger and emotion, they have always been part of any political system, have they not? I mean, I'm thinking of the guy, the congressman who was beaten up on the floor of the House of Representatives in the 1850s, caned to death almost. People have been angry forever with their government and their representatives. So it, in a sense, it's not new.
Yeah, and there are certain buttons that can be pushed that are universal and will never go away. I mean, the mere fact that we use the button metaphor, I think then refers back to the sort of evolutionary heritage of humanity, right? So that we have certain ways of reacting to social situations,
right,
which are immediate and intuitive and highly emotional, and are features of human nature not likely to go away. You know, so in the business, like one of them is the in-group versus out-group bias, right? And so it's very easy to polarize people, to think of us versus them. And it can be a very useful disposition because by dividing people up into groups, you can actually motivate people to higher levels of in-group effort.
You mean to better themselves or to...
Yeah, and to act more cooperatively towards fellow group members. So that's why we have like the house system in high schools and colleges and universities and so on. Is you say, oh, you're part of this group. And then we stage little competitions with the group down the hall. And it can be useful to the extent that it actually builds social solidarity within the group. But it can also be very negative to the extent that it
excludes. I
mean, yeah. And so ideally you want to have people opposed to a kind of abstract other that they actually don't really have a whole lot of contact with, so that the competitive aspect of it doesn't eclipse the cooperative aspect. But I should say, like, that in-group, out-group thing is extremely primordial, and it's an easy button to push. And it is important to recognize, for example, that people will often say, oh, you know, racism is the problem or whatever. But actually underlying it is actually this in-group thing.
Yeah.
Because what you saw with Britain and Brexit was you had people pushing that same in-group, out-group button. But in this case, it was against East European, primarily Polish immigrants. Right. And the thing about Poles to the UK is that they're overwhelmingly white and Christian. Right. So it had nothing to do with race. It just had to do with us versus them. And so it is important to recognize that us versus them thing, which Trump pushes that same button, right? But it's like the same universal button. So that's not going to change. The question is just the extent to which people are trying to make political, you know, mileage out of that particular tendency.
I'm a little nervous talking about Donald Trump and pushing buttons. I have to tell you that. My guest this morning is Joseph Heath. He's a political philosopher in the Department of Philosophy and at the Monk School of Global Affairs and Public Policy in Toronto. We're talking about the role of anger in politics today, and particularly in the swamplands of the politics to the south. How much do politicians exploit fear, real fear and real anger of voters?
Yeah, I think it's highly, highly variable. I mean, one of the things that politicians have figured out in the last maybe 20 years is that there are actually very few issues that actually move voters to change, like that actually drive voter behavior. So if you were to naively look at So you do a poll of Canadians and you say, like, what's important to you, right? Well, you know, there's been a significant narrowing of the difference between political parties. And so it's not as though political parties are, like, you know, super out
black
there.
Black and white.
Right?
Yeah.
So, you know, often in newspapers will do these polls, say, what's the most important issue to you? And the Canadians will say, like, oh, healthcare, right? And then you'll have an election campaign and no one's talking about healthcare. Why is that? It's because Canadians don't perceive the three major political parties as having really any interesting differences of opinion on healthcare. And so it doesn't drive voter behavior. In that, believe it or not, nobody actually votes for the NDP because of its stance on healthcare. There's a package of things. And so what matters to voters abstractly is not necessarily what changes voter behavior. So if you do really fine-grained studies of voter attitudes, what you find is that there's maybe five or six issues, though, that will actually change people's votes.
Right.
And so what political parties focus on are these very, very narrow issues that will actually drive voter behavior. So an example of this is when Rhona Ambrose was Minister of Health, she appeared to be spending her entire time talking about and worrying about safe injection sites. Right? So when you think about, like, healthcare in Canada, it's kind of a big portfolio,
sure.
right?
Yeah.
But, you know, probably 90% of her public pronouncements and so on were on safe injection sites, right? Why is that? It's because something like cancer care in Canada, like, no one votes for anybody based on their views on that. Whereas safe injection sites was an issue that was a wedge issue that you could actually get people to change votes over.
All right. But if you go back a few years in Ontario, we had the scandal and the disaster, the tragedy of Walkerton, where the local water supply was toxic. It was killing people. I think it killed 7 or 8 people. The next election, and that was under the Conservatives in Ontario, the next election they were voted out. And a lot of people say that Walkerton had some effect, the anger about Walkerton, about moving people to vote against the Tories.
Yeah. And, you know, there's been a lot of interesting political science work on this that I don't do, but I kind of I hear about, I see occasional presentations on. It used to be really hard to tell if that's what was really driving voters, simply because we didn't have fine-grained enough polling instruments. So if you're doing a sample of 500 people and it's really expensive and you do it once a year, all that sort of fine-grained stuff is actually going to fall out. So you're not going to be able to tell. So there was a big debate in political science as to whether or not issues like that actually changed behavior. And the general consensus was that it didn't. So people would say, like, oh, it's economic fundamentals. I mean, something that happened 2 years ago, it's not like people are going to be sitting there waiting for their opportunity to get revenge in the ballot box. That consensus is starting to change a little bit more, in part because the internet and big data and so on has given us far more fine-grained data about political behavior. And so there are now people arguing that issues can change behavior. But again, things have a short shelf life, right? So the other thing about anger is it's pretty ephemeral. People don't really stay angry for years and years on specific issues like that. I mean, there was a really interesting case during the last federal election where, the Conservative Party had sort of real bad luck in the sense that they had made sort of being tougher on refugees.
Yes.
Really part of one of their core, not only policy directions, but also communications directions.
Barbaric practices and all that.
Yeah. And then in the middle of the election campaign, this tragic photograph appears of the boy drowned on the beach.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden there's this wave of sympathy for refugees. And you can imagine like a particularly cold-blooded conservative strategist saying, oh, but like what are the chances, right? We've been like for 6 years, we've been basically like demonizing refugees. Who could have imagined that suddenly Canadians would become super sympathetic to refugees right in the middle of electoral campaign? It was bad luck for them. But again, the evidence suggests that it didn't actually move polls for more than like a week. And that after that, it kind of just settled back to baseline.
Justin Trudeau's father was always pushing the idea of reason over passion. That was, I think, made him the politician he was. Does reason stand a chance in politics?
Well, Trudeau's ultimate conclusion was no. He sort of abandoned that slogan quite dramatically. And he was once recorded leaving the House of Commons saying, if blood and guts is what they want, then I'll give them blood and guts, right? I mean, Trudeau, I like to remind people that Trudeau's reversal on this has had enormous consequences, right? So his initial view was that Quebec separatists were using all these emotional appeals.
That's right.
So he was going to defend federalism, you know, by the, you know,
cold,
the
cool
cold
reason.
Light of morning, right?
Yeah.
And then when he reversed himself, he was like, okay, the only way to fight fire is with fire. And therefore, let's get maple leaves and let's have a national anthem and let's make it Canada Day instead of Dominion Day and so forth. So he kind of, you know, inadvertently became the father of modern Canadian nationalism with this fairly cynical attempt to create an emotional style of nationalism at the federal level to combat Quebec separatism. That's been wildly successful. Like, I grew up in a Canada where we sang God Sing the Queen in school,
yeah.
And you never saw maple leaves anywhere. This is in Saskatchewan. And now you walk around the streets of Toronto and maple leaves all over the place and, you know, beavers and all this kind of stuff. This is all like Trudeau's capitulation to the forces of unreason.
Is there ever a circumstance or a series of circumstances where anger, emotion, passion is appropriate in politics? And I'm thinking when everybody saw the footage, I think it was in Birmingham, of the dogs attacking the civil rights workers and the Freedom Riders. People saw that. I think they became angry, and I think something happened, no?
I mean, I think outrage at injustice, like righteous anger, is the obvious place to go to as a sort of virtuous political emotion. And there's lots of that going on too. I mean, so the Me Too movement being the obvious example, there was one recent study that showed that American women are actually significantly angrier than American men on average, which is surprising because anger usually is a male thing predominantly. So certainly the Me Too movement example of predominantly women expressing outrage and anger and then having important social consequences. I'm just like super nervous about anger. And especially when it's propagated through social media that have that kind of snowballing effect. And so my inclination is to think that righteous anger, the problem is that, I mean, everybody thinks their anger is righteous anger. And so what we call righteous anger tends to be the anger that we agree with. And the unrighteous anger is the anger that we don't disagree with. So I'm just not sure that the anger is doing all that much work other than sort of motivating people. So I guess I would put it that way, is to say that all angry people think that they're – I mean, well, put it this way. All angry people think of their actions as – and almost all violent people think of their actions as being punitive towards someone who's wronged them. And so if you, like, go up to, like, an American racist who's, like, spitting venom on the street corner and you say, what are you so angry about? They'll give you a list of grievances. They're not going to be like, you know, I want to dominate and crush all those before me.
Right.
They'll give you – start to say, look, this is what's happened to me and all the ways in which I've been harmed, and so I'm lashing back at the people who've hurt me. I mean, a phenomenal percentage of criminals view their actions as having been retaliatory against some slight. Mm-hmm. So the police did this to me, or my boss did this to me, or whatever, right? So people in general tend to view their own antisocial behavior in moralized terms. So you can't sort this out just by looking at people's emotions.
But if we can't sort it out, should we at least be wary of even positive emotions in politics? We should be careful about it.
Yeah, we haven't really talked about sunny ways and the power of positive emotions.
Right.
I think part of what gives negative emotions their force, I mean, I do think that if you put positive, happy emotions against negative emotions, right, that the positive ones tend to lose.
Why is that? I
think in part it's because our moral judgments are actually very tied up with our punitive reactions. Right? And so negative emotions tend to be closely associated with the sense of right and wrong, just and unjust. So we see something unjust, we get angry. But people are very self-serving. I mean, some people are totally right, but other people make very self-serving use of this. And so often it's their sense of having been – it's their sense of grievance that motivates people to be angry and to act as they do. And that seems to, you know, stick a lot more than positive emotions. So it's not as though when I see someone do something that's right, I have this great happy feeling. It's only when people go way over the call of duty that I might tend to have a particularly warm feeling. But when I see people just going about their everyday business, behaving the way that they're supposed to, it doesn't make me happy. It leaves me emotionally neutral. But when I see a person breaking the rule, you know, like 10 items in the express lane, then I get angry, right?
But that raises the question of the role of media in all of this. Plane lands safely at Pearson is not a news story. We tend to focus on the yelling and the screaming rather than the calm, if there ever has been such a thing, as the calm discourse of political interaction.
Yeah, one of the reasons I'm really popular with the media is that I'm one of the last people to want to blame the media for various social ills.
We can take it.
I think it's really easy to overestimate how much the media is responsible for these things. But I think in today's age, I think the media is even less responsible for it, simply because so much of communications now is just circumventing the traditional media. Yeah. There's a lot of things that the media was doing in the 80s and 90s and, you know, discovery of what makes for good television that were really toxic to political discourse. discourse and that tended to pump up emotions and so on. But that's not the world we live in now. Like, that's not what's driving these new phenomena. So now we have platforms instead of media, right? So we've got social media platforms. But confusingly, they have different dynamics. So Facebook and Twitter have a certain kind of dynamic, but Reddit has a different dynamic. But those are allowing people to communicate directly with each other without any gatekeepers in the way. And that's what's generating a lot of these new dynamics. And so increasingly the old media, I think, has less power and control over any of this stuff.
What is the end point in all this? I mean, if these ingredients tend to further polarize our politics, or in Europe or in the U.S. or whatever, and create this arena of the politics of resentment, of anger, what's the end point?
Marshall McLuhan sort of had something right when he said that you know, the media of the message, the thought is that different media have different kinds of tones and they promote certain forms of communication more effectively than others. And that was true of radio, it was true of television. It's certainly true of different social media platforms as well, right? And so like mobbing seems to be encouraged by Twitter. Pointless argumentation seems to be encouraged by Twitter, right? So it's important to recognize that something like Twitter is not neutral. I mean, McLuhan's big point was television is not neutral. You know, like a lot of these other ones are like mobby. Like that is, they encourage like herd or mob thinking. You know, so any media that is like, you know, recommend this to your friends is going to generate that kind of mechanism, right? So I would hope that in the future, at least, is where we acquire greater wisdom about these media having their own kinds of dynamics, and therefore to be careful of using a particular kind of medium for a particular message if the dynamic is one which is going to tend to obliterate the message you're trying to send. None of these are transparent. The thing is, right, you know, they all have their own sort of tones and tendencies.
God, it gets more complicated by the hour.
Yeah, and it gets more complicated as well because I talk about platforms, but people keep inventing new platforms and kids keep changing platforms, right? And so there's a huge difficulty of intergenerational communication as well now because younger people are using these platforms that nobody over the age of 30 is using. So their communications have a certain kind of dynamic that you and I are not seeing.
You must see it in the classroom, though, don't you? Or...
Yeah, but what you see it as the manifestation of these like weird forms of social deviance, and you're wondering like where did that come from? You know, so all of the sort of countercultural and subcultural impulses that used to sort of get played out on the street, are now just totally on the internet, and people are kind of self-radicalizing and arguing with each other, and there's all this stuff going on in these internet communities, and all of a sudden they show up fully formed in real life. And yeah, so as the professor, I'm like, whoa, like where did that come from?
And Donald J. Trump is the beneficiary of all this.
To some extent, although it's easy to overestimate. When you're talking about getting elected, like old people vote a lot more than young people. And television is still king when it comes to driving political behavior.
Thank you, sir. It's always good to talk to you. Thanks for coming in.
That's my pleasure.
Joseph Heath is professor in the Department of Philosophy and at the Monk School of Global Affairs and Public Policy, the University of Toronto. He is also the author of Enlightenment 2.0, Restoring Sanity to Our Politics, Our Economy, and Our Lives. This morning, he was with me in our studio in Toronto. You're listening to the Sunday Edition across Canada on CBC Radio 1 and across the United States on Sirius XM Radio Channel 169. My name is Michael Enright.